Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is March 10, 2005. This is the opening of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and today we will be considering House Bill 5006, which relates to the budget for Commission on the Blind. We welcome Linda Mock, Administrator for the Commission on the Blind, and Don Dart, who's the Chairman of the Commission. If you please come forward.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Mock, and I am the administrator of the Oregon Commission for the Blind. And I have with me today the chair of the commission, Don Dart, who will be assisting me with the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would just like to begin by giving a brief overview of our purpose, and then I'm going to turn it over to Don. As you know, individuals who are blind are among the most disadvantaged groups in our state. The purpose of the Commission for the Blind is to empower blind Oregonians to live independently, enjoy self-determination, make choices, and contribute to society, pursuing meaningful careers and enjoying full inclusion and integration into our economy and our social life. Our services help blind Oregonians become self-sufficient through a program that is a state-federal partnership funded largely with federal funds. Our agency plays a leadership role in promoting the employment of people who are blind, helping them fulfill their aspirations for meaningful and gainful employment and independent living. I would now like to turn the presentation over to Don Dart, who is the chair of the commission and a former recipient of services from our agency. Our services assisted him to continue his career as an attorney after becoming blind. Don will be describing the agency mission, chief goals, and history.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn. And Mr. Chairman, Lynn and I have divided up some of the elements in phase one. We'd just like to go back and forth a bit here, giving describing the in summary form what we've included in our presentation. With regard to the agency history, rather than recite for you all that we've listed on page three, I thought I would point out, if I could, just a couple of things which I regard certainly as milestones in the history of the agency. This is an independent commission that was formed in 1937. The amendments to the Federal Vocational Rehab Act in 1973 was really the beginning of what we might regard as our modern agency. It really established the legal structure under which we currently operate. This is a heavily federalized program in that the large bulk of our funds do come from the federal government, and of course with that many of the requirements and mandates contained in the Federal Voc Rehab Act. Another particular thing you'd find under the history that I think is a particularly important event, if you will, is 1991, the establishment of the Technology Center at the agency center here in Portland, which I think really marked a significant shift from what had been the old model of Industries for the Blind and a sheltered workshop model to a more appropriate model for teaching the technology skills necessary for legally blind Oregonians to become gainfully employed. If there are any questions with regard to the history of the agency, I'd be very glad to discuss those.
Okay.
Do you have the next ones?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next, I was going to go over, beginning on page four, what the key components of rehabilitation are within our current system. Vocational rehabilitation is a comprehensive program that results in employment. It is time-limited and goal-oriented, and one of the tenets that is strong within the Rehabilitation Act is the tenet of informed consumer choice. Individuals in our program are able to choose the goal that they are seeking to obtain, the kind of employment, and we help them really reach their maximum potential through the rehabilitation program. It is very individualized, so each individual's plan would look different from someone else's. There are certainly common components, but we really do look very individual individually at each individual, their disability, the impacts it has on them, and then provide services that will help them reduce those barriers and move into employment. It does require specialized, qualified staff who have the skills needed to provide the rehabilitation services, such as learning to travel with a cane, braille, and technology that Don was referred to. We also do a continual analysis of our program effectiveness and customer satisfaction as a part of the rehabilitation program. On page 5, you see a little diagram, which is the client process. And you'll see that initially an individual is diagnosed with a disability, in our case, legal blindness, and they would be referred to the agency. The majority of our referrals do come to us from the medical community. Then we do an assessment through our counselors of the individual's strengths and needs, and then develop an individualized plan. We then deliver the services of that plan. The individual will attain their goal, hopefully, and we at that point would do what we call closing their case after 90 days of successful employment. And then we have follow-up to make sure that they are able to maintain that program, that employment, and if they need additional services, we can help them have those services in order to maintain employment. If you look at the next page on 6, you'll see a graph which just shows you the historical program growth that we have experienced within the vocational rehabilitation program. And you'll see that we have, we go back to 1990 on that chart, really increased the number of individuals that we're serving through time so that we are up in the 900 level of individuals that are served. The average cost per case in 2004 for case services was $2,257.
Would you mind defining what is meant by service or serving individuals? What kind of service are all 906 receiving at this time?
Well, we'll get a little more into the program detail later, but the services that we provide are really a wide range of services. Everything from teaching an individual how to travel with a cane, a very important skill for a blind individual, teaching them how to use alternative methods for accessing technology such as voice output, enlargement, braille, alternative skills for daily living so that they can function safely in their home.
No, I understand. We'll go through that in a little bit more detail later. What I really meant was, are all of the 906 currently receiving services, or is that a population, some of which have received services in the past and some are receiving currently?
That number would include everyone from applicant forward. So once we have taken an application and we have them, we go through a process of determining their eligibility, which is the process of obtaining medical information, which documents that they are, in fact, legally blind, and then identifying the barriers. It would be from that point forward until a case closure, which is when they are closed, successfully employed.
All right, so all are actively involved.
Yeah, from the eligibility process onward, yes.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to turn it back over to Don, who will describe the target groups that we serve.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the target groups that we serve, or the population that we serve, statutorily, are blind Oregonians, those who meet the legal definition of legally blind, which is an acuity of 2200 or worse in the best corrected eye, or a field of vision that's restricted to 15 degrees or less. Within that large group, there are essentially four subgroups. The first one we've identified are youth transitioning from school. These are primarily high schoolers who are transitioning from high school into the job force or into higher education, and in conjunction with the various school districts, and particularly the educational service districts, we have a transition program to try to take them from high school either into the job force or into higher education as effectively and efficiently as possible. Secondly, and by far the largest group that we serve, are working-age adult blind Oregonians who are seeking employment. That's where the bulk of our services are directed. The third group, a relatively small group, are those who are developmentally disabled and also legally blind. We have Industries for the Blind program that is run in conjunction with Multnomah County. As I said, serves a fairly small population, all of which is funded with other funds, not federal or state general fund dollars. The third group The fourth group are those who are served by our Older Blind program. It's a program, again, a relatively small program that's administered with largely federal funds on a 9-to-1 match. Those are the four subgroups that we serve. As I said, the working age blind Oregonians truly receive the bulk of what we do at the commission, with the goal, of course, of having them gainfully employed or returning the newly blinded individuals to employment. I believe next there's information on our organization. We are an independent commission established by statute. We're self-governed by a board of seven commissioners, five of whom under the statute must be legally blind. There are two other members who may or may not be legally blind but do not have to be, and who represent various interests or professions, for example, those with a background in education or blind rehabilitation, an ophthalmologist, for example, we currently have on the board, business owners, interests and professions that, again, by statute are to be represented on the commission. And we each serve a 2-year term for a maximum of 3 terms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There is an organizational chart if you wanted to take a look at it briefly on page 9, which shows major programs within the agency, and I'm going to go into an overview now of those programs. Essentially, we have 5 programs within the agency. The largest and central program is our rehabilitation services program, which includes vocational rehabilitation and the Older Blind Independent Living Program. We have an Orientation Career Center, a Business Enterprise Program, the Oregon Industries for the Blind, and then an Administration Department, which supports all of those other activities. If you turn to page 11, you will see a program description of rehabilitation services. Rehabilitation services is funded with 78.7% federal funds and 21.3% state and other funds. It is Title I of the Rehabilitation Act. And the purpose of this program, as we've been describing, is the central purpose of the agency, which is to help individuals who are legally blind to obtain and maintain employment. We help businesses retain or hire qualified blind employees also, and we consider businesses to be a secondary customer of our agency. We do have an eligibility criteria. We've described it to you a little bit, that the individuals must be legally blind and they must have barriers related to employment as a result of their blindness, and they must want to work. An example of a barrier related to blindness would be, they're pretty obvious when you think about it, but someone who's unable to read regular size print because of their blindness, someone who can't read a computer screen, someone who can't drive. So when counselors are meeting with an individual, they identify those barriers that that person is experiencing and then design the program so that they can overcome those barriers and find alternative methods of travel, such as using public transportation and a white cane. We do have statewide services that we provide from 8 different locations. Here are some example services we've discussed a little bit. We have professional counseling. We do an evaluation of the strengths and challenges of the individuals. We give them what we call adaptive skills training, the specialized skills of blindness. We provide adaptive technology for people on their work site so that they can have the voice output or braille or enlargement that they need. We do job development, job retention, and we have a special program for transitioning youth and a summer work experience program. The next page, on 12, you'll see a description of our summer work experience program, which is a program specifically designed for youth who are in the special education programs as visually impaired youth in our state, to help them gain the type of work experience that many non-disabled youth experience while they're in their high school years. We found that many of the students, when they were exiting school, were coming to us with really little knowledge of the world of work and no real work experience. So we really wanted to give them that opportunity and develop a work ethic and basic work skills. So we actually initiated this program over 25 years ago. And it really is located in two places within the state. We have a program in Portland and a program in Salem. It does provide community-based summer jobs for the youth. And they live in Portland at the campus of Reed College in Salem. They are on the campus of the School for the Blind. They work on, in the community. They take transportation back and forth to their job. We provide mentoring so that they have an opportunity to be around successful blind adults. They also have a lot of opportunities for independent living skills training. In the READ setting, the students cook their own meals. They shop for their own meals. They take TriMet public transportation back and forth. The Salem program is a supported employment model where the students need more support in order to function on the job, so they tend to have job coaches for that. And we also do a lot of fun activities for the students as well, providing a lot of leisure activities, camping, hiking, whitewater rafting, a variety of things, which also helps them develop their leisure skills. It's a very important program for us, and we have gotten really good results of doing some follow-up studies 10 years out to look at the rate of employment of the students who had been through that, and it was about 75%, which when you compare it to the overall unemployment rate for people with disabilities, which is around 70%. It really does have a long-term impact to get that early work experience. On page 13, you'll see a description of our Orientation and Career Center. This is our central training program. It is a residential training setting in Portland where we do provide apartments for individuals who are from other parts of the state. If they're from Portland, they commute back and forth. And it is our comprehensive training program. Here is where we deal with all of the skills we've been talking about relative to adjustment to blindness. We have a technology center there with a variety of types of adaptive technology. We can evaluate the individuals on what type they need and will work for their situation, train them on it. We train them on what we call orientation mobility, which is learning to travel with a white cane and use public transportation. We train on Braille, daily living skills. We have a wood shop where we train individuals how to use power equipment. And we do job site modifications, evaluations, and recommendations out of the technology center once the individual is ready for employment so that we can make sure that they have access to whatever information. And you're probably aware, as our work sites are changing and most of us now have to access computers, this is a very important area, as Don pointed out, for our agency in really having the ability to have successful placements. The next page talks about our older blind program. This one enjoys an even more favorable federal match. It only requires 10% of state or other funds for a 90% federal match. The purpose of this program is to help individuals who are over 55 to live independently in their home and to keep them within their homes as long as possible, providing them a lot of what we call daily living skills, practical things, how to set your oven to 350 degrees, how to mark your spices, how to safely cook, how to travel with a cane, you know, the very basics of living in your home independently. This service is provided in individuals' homes, so we have teachers throughout the state who go in and work with the individuals in their homes. And the skills are very similar to what we're providing the working age population, but the goal is an employment for these individuals. It's just to maintain their independence. And, of course, if someone over 55 is interested in employment, we would serve them in the vocational rehabilitation program. Page 15 talks about our business enterprise program, and this is a program which is operated under the Federal Randolph-Shepard Act, and it provides business management opportunities and food service and vending for our guardians who are blind. Our food service is mostly located in state, federal, and municipal buildings, and probably some of you have experienced some of our cafeterias and snack bars. We have quite a few of them here in the Salem area. We have 4 cafeterias currently, 9 snack bars, 6 dry sands, and 7 vending routes for a total of 26 units. The agency provides the training for the individuals who are going to go into this program. We then license them, saying that they are ready to manage a unit. They are really independent business individuals managing their own business. They have employees who work for them in many cases. They really operate as an independent business, sort of on a franchise almost basis, because the contracts for the snack bars or cafeterias are with the agency, and then we contract with the licensed blind vendors. They pay what is called a set-aside to us, which is a 11% in our state of their profits are paid back to the agency, which are used for really 5 purposes, which are outlined and the Randolph-Shepard Act, saying that they can be used for the repair and maintenance of equipment, to purchase equipment, for management services of the program, and for benefits to individuals in the program. The next program I want to talk about is the last of the direct service ones of the agency, and it is our Industries for the Blind program, and it is 100% other funds. There are no state or federal funds that go into this program. This is a program for individuals who are both developmentally disabled and blind, and it's operated in conjunction with Multnomah County Mental Health. This is a site where individuals can go and perform work activities and paid work as well. In order to be in this program, they are referred to us from Multnomah County Mental Health Services, and then the money for those individuals really follows the individual, as I'm sure you're familiar with the county programs. The services that we provide, we have job coaching for individuals that are in supported employment. We help place them in supported employment, and then there is sheltered employment activities that are paid usually on a piece rate for individuals. We also have some individuals who are there who are doing skill building activities, and we currently are serving about 45 individuals in that program with 15 staff. The staff are not state employees. There are no state employees employed. So when you look at the numbers of individuals within the agency that are our FTs, these individuals are not included in that number. And the final program that we have, of course, is administration, which is funded through our vocational rehabilitation program at the 21% to 78% rate. And it provides overall agency direction and supervision. We work to promote positive relationships with our community partners. We have human resource development, administrative service supports, and we also support the activities of the commission board. They provide direct support to our rehabilitation programs, such as purchasing, budgeting, fiscal reporting, and human resource management for those programs. It's also responsible for the agency accounting, fiscal records, property, control payroll, and expenses monitoring. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Don, who will talk about the top three priority outcomes for our agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 18, we've identified those three priority outcomes, the first two of which relate very directly to the vocational rehab programs of the agency, which, again, is really at the core of what we do. The first is the indication, or the first indication, rather, is the number of clients who we help obtain gainful employment or remain employed or return to work. Many folks, including myself, who had had a career or a profession, who aren't ready to give it up and who want to remain at work, obviously in need of certain skills to be able to do that. And probably our number one measurement of whether we're doing what we think we should be doing is looking at the number of folks that we help stay at work or return to work. And the second, connected with the first, is examining just how gainfully employed are these folks, looking at the average hourly wage of folks that we've helped return to employment or obtain employment. It's not our desire to train people necessarily for minimum wage jobs. We want them to have as good paying jobs as anybody else. And one of the measurements that we use is exactly to judge the success of how gainful this employment is to look at how much money these folks are making. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that we've included in the back of the packet some numbers that I assume Linda would be willing to discuss if there are any questions. And thirdly is the older blind program that Linda has detailed, looking simply at the number of older blind Oregonians who are served by the agency. The objective, again, being to help these older blind, being defined as 55 and over, to help these individuals remain independent and self-sufficient in their own home, oftentimes as opposed to seeking services from other agencies who may have to provide, frankly, more expensive support. If we can help these folks stay in their own home, take care of themselves effectively and safely, we feel we're doing not only service to these individuals but to the state as well, because we're providing very efficient, primarily federally funded services, in many cases, to keep these people from having to take advantage of other state-funded programs.
thanks. On page 19, you'll see a chart which shows...
For a moment, Representative Hanna.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I kind of look at those outcomes, number one, number of Oregonians who are blind employed, why aren't we maybe measuring those who want to be, or the percentage of those who want to be employed that are employed? Because just the raw number, I mean, if we're only getting a few of the people that would like to be and we're not getting a high percentage, our measurement might not be very good. From that standpoint, it's just a point of reference. And same thing really on number three, number of older blind individuals served. If we're just counting a raw number and we're only getting the 10% of those that are blind that could be served, the number might not be a good measurement. So more to the point of the population, what percentage of those folks are we serving?
I would make one comment and turn it over to Linda for further comment. But with regard to the first one, as we've indicated earlier, our voc rehab services for blind Oregonians offer to those folks not only who qualify and who are eligible, but who want to work. These have to be working age, primarily working age individuals whose objective it is to either remain employed or return to gainful employment. And I agree with you, if we look at a gross number, it probably doesn't mean much or help us in evaluating how effective we're being. But we're starting with the assumption that those folks who come in and go through the application process want to work. And it's that population that we can then measure as to how successful we're being of those folks, how many people actually end up gainfully employed and how many do not. And with regard to the second comment on the older blind program, to be perfectly candid, I don't believe that we have the criteria in place to as objectively measure our success in that program as we do our primary voc rehab program, mainly because we're dealing more with quality of life than we are hard numbers. Again, these are folks we want to keep in their homes, living as independently as possible, and quite candidly, it's difficult to measure performance on that as opposed to simply the number of folks that we're reaching.
Two things that could influence it. One is, do you have any kind of a waiting list?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any waiting list of people for benefits and for opportunity to participate?
For services?
Yes.
Yes, we do. And, of course, it varies according to the size of the caseload and applicants coming in and successful cases being closed. But we do typically have some folks on what is essentially a wait list. They're waiting for a variety of services, whatever the extent of the services may be, whether minimal or the full extent of the services that we offer. We've done what I think is an outstanding job in the last year or two of decreasing the number of folks on that list and effectively serving those folks with the programs that we offer. But yes, there are at times people waiting for our services, and that quite frankly, simply a matter of funding. We have the resources to serve those, to serve many of those folks, and others we simply don't.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, I'll just add a little bit to what Don said about the number of individuals who are employed. We do also have within our performance measures a percentage, which you'll see later when we get into those performance measures. We call it our rehabilitation rate. And that really is a measure of the number of individuals or the percentage of individuals who come into the vocational rehabilitation program, meaning that they have been determined eligible and that they're interested in employment. What percentage of them are successful? So we do have a measure which does do that. We just didn't choose it as one of our top three. We're trying to highlight the top three here. And I also would concur that we need to work on developing some more outcome-based measure for the Elder Blind Program. It is something that we have kind of struggled with in the past, and I've been actually discussing it with our LFO analyst. And we are contemplating putting something new in place. This is something that I think has evolved over time. Initially, we were trying to measure the number of individuals who did not go into higher levels of assisted living, but it seemed to be difficult to measure because it's hard to measure something that didn't happen. And so it was coming back to really our professional staff's judgment on whether or not they thought that the services prevented them from needing to move into, you know, a nursing home or assisted living of some sort. So we had moved to just counting the number. What we're contemplating now is to do a follow-up, perhaps 90 days out after the services have been provided, to see if the individuals still are independent in their home, and really just do it as a part of our program evaluation, adding something that would be more of an outcome-based type of a measure versus this is really an output, the number that is served.
Mm-hmm. And the second issue is the outreach to those that are blind that could qualify. Because, you know, if we're focusing on the programs, which is certainly appropriate, it really is only meaningful if we know that out of all of those that are blind in Oregon who could possibly qualify, that they are informed about it. And then, you know, if they don't want to do it, that's mm-hmm. fine. And then of those that would like to participate, how many of them have the ability to participate, which goes to your waiting list and waiting times, delay times, and then of those that do participate, what are the outcomes? And so I think it's a three-step.
Yes, Chair Richardson, I agree with you on that. And it is something where we have struggled with the fact that, and we'll get to this in a little more detail later too, we are in an order of selection in our vocational rehabilitation program. And in our older blind program, we're really restricted by the number of teachers that we have in the communities. And I really feel that particularly the older blind program is underfunded for the number of individuals who could benefit from it. And so we have restricted our outreach activities because, you know, as an agency, you don't want to do a lot of outreach and get people on wait lists so that you know, they're waiting. And it, so it is something that we have contemplated, when to do outreach and when not to do it. We certainly know in the older blind program, for example, when we have put teachers into a community, there would have been no wait lists. There would have been no individuals identified probably in that community needing our services. And when we put a teacher in that community, suddenly there are hundreds of people who need our services. This happened to us in Coos Bay. It has happened to us in Roseburg. So as we have put teachers in new communities and they begin to do outreach, meeting with the medical community, meeting with the other service providers, seniors and persons with disabilities, for example, we certainly do identify them. So I think that's a very real problem where particularly the older blind population can be kind of an invisible population who will be experiencing a vision loss, and we know it's very common as people age, but they don't know that there are services that could help them be independent. Their families don't know that, and so they tend to move them, you know, into nursing homes. We hear those kinds of stories frequently where someone may be experiencing other health issues and they're still managing to be independent, but once they lose their vision, usually due to macular degeneration in the senior population, the family will be, well, okay, now we need to move them into a nursing home because they aren't safe in their home anymore. And we can really delay that by providing the training that we do. But because our program is so limited in scope, we don't do a lot of outreach to create these wait lists. So it is a balance that we're struggling with.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gary Hansen from North Portland. Two questions. One, are there services available for people that have maybe already reached assisted living or in a foster home or in a nursing home who lose their sight?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, yes, we would provide services. We try to help individuals meet their maximum level of independence, and it is very individualized. And so some individuals may be living in an assisted living situation where they could benefit from some of our services, but not necessarily all of our services. But they may want to be able to learn to read Braille. They may want to use magnification to read, but maybe they don't have the physical ability to be able to travel independently with a cane or even to cook meals. So we really look at it very individually. I mean, if you think of most of the individuals we serve have been sighted and have lost their vision, so we start out with some very basic skills. I mean, we have individuals in assisted living who want to learn how to cut their own meat so that they can eat independently and not have someone else have to cut it. So we really do look at various levels, and we would provide those kinds of services that would help them be as independent as possible.
The second question, in looking at your budget, obviously we're at 90% federal funds and about 10% state. Have you maximized the federal funds, or if there were more state funds available, would we be able to draw in more federal funds?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen, yes, we have. In the older blind, we have definitely maximized. And it has been a program, if you'll note, that has been growing a little more than the cost of living because there is a national need for the program, and so they have been increasing it, but it's still probably not meeting the need. I would guess that we could probably double that program in this state to really meet the need, but we are currently maximizing it.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, thank you. On page 19, you'll see that there's a chart which just outlines the types of job, and this is just to follow up on what Don was saying, that we really do strive to have professional-level jobs. 43% of the individuals we placed last year had professional jobs, 22% clerical, and 13% in the service industry. And the next page will show you, on page 20, our average hourly wage at closure, which this last year was $14.72, which we're quite proud of. That's very competitive wage for individuals who have just completed the program. On page 21, I just want to emphasize that vocational rehabilitation services are a good investment. We successfully employ clients who then pay state and federal taxes throughout their working life. And on the average, we've done some calculations here just to show you what kind of savings we have. On average, Oregon's contribution to the vocational rehabilitation program is paid back in less than 9 months of employment of the individual after they complete the program. The federal portion is paid back in less than 22 months. In addition, we are reducing the service dependence on public assistance. Successfully employing clients are less likely to use public assistance, and the average savings over a lifetime per individual who is an SSI recipient who goes off of benefits is $243,000 for females and $208,000 for males. The average savings to the Oregon Health Plan over the lifetime per individual who goes off of benefits is $125,000 for females and $107,000 for males. We calculated these by looking at the average age at closure, the number of working years that they had left, and the cost of the benefits to those individuals. So you can see that it is really a cost-effective program overall on both a federal and a state level. The Elder Vine program is also a good investment. And we help those individuals maintain their independence in their home, as we have discussed. And if you look at our average, you know, cost for that program, it's just a small portion of what it would cost 1 year to maintain the individual in a nursing home, which is almost $50,000 a year. So just delaying that is a great savings to the state of Oregon. Next, I wanted to go into our performance measures a little more, and if you look at page 23, it will outline the performance measures that we're currently using. Some of them we've talked a little bit about already. The number of individuals who are served in the VR program, the number of individuals placed in employment, the percentage of those individuals served in the vocational rehabilitation program who successfully complete the program, the question that Representative Hannah asked, the average wage of individuals who are placed in employment. We also measure the number of students that we serve in the summer work experience program, the number of individuals that we serve at the Orientation and Career Center, the number of individuals served by the Older Blind Program, the cost per client in the Older Blind Program, and our per-unit revenue growth for our business enterprise program. These were all included in our progress report from the Progress Performance Board. Now, if you'd like to, we'll go through and take an individual look at these. Page 24 shows you the number of individuals that we have served. It's the same graph that we showed earlier, where you'll see that we have had pretty steady growth in the program over recent years. On page 25, you see the number of successful closures who were placed by the agency. You'll see that we did have a dip in the year 2002 and 2003, and we are recovering from that. I'm sure you all remember what Oregon was experiencing during that period of time. Obviously, our economy was suffering. We had the highest unemployment rate in the nation during that period of time. We also implemented an order of selection, which we'll explain a little later, but that does slow down the movement of individuals into employment because you are serving individuals with the most significant disabilities and it takes longer to provide the services. So We have currently serving 100% individuals who have significant disabilities. And the average length of time for individuals that we closed out last year was 3.4 years. So it does take a period of time for individuals to go through all the training and rehabilitation that we provide. And we do define employment as at least 90 days of maintaining a job before we count it as a successful closure. The next page is the what we call rehabilitation rate, which is the percentage of individuals who are successful in obtaining their employment goal, who have entered the program. And you'll see that our rate this last year was at 79%. Before that, it was at 60%, and that, again, was a pretty tough year for us given the economy, and we also had lost quite a few staff during that year to retirements. We actually lost 20% of our staff in 1 year, and we have a lot of staff who stay for a long time. And when PERS looked like it was going to change, we had kind of a mass exodus. Our performance measure for the Summer Work Experience Program is really the number of individuals served. It's pretty steady. It's pretty much our capacity. We have been working at that program, as I said, for a long time with the regional programs for the visually impaired and the education services in the state. And I feel that we are serving the individuals in that program who are interested in it and eligible for it at this point. The next performance measure is the number served by the Orientation and Career Center. In 2003, we changed the way that we count individuals. We previously had a count of the number of services, and now we have the so it was a duplicated count looking at individuals, and now it's the number of individuals who are served in the program. And we provide both services to independent living and vocational rehabilitation clients in that program. And the number in the Older Blind Program, you'll see this is one that has had quite a bit of variability through the years, and it has been really, I think, demonstrating what Chair Richardson was referring to. When we have more funding, we serve more individuals. If you look at the 96, 97, 98, we were fortunate during that period of time to get two grants. They were both federal grants to provide older blind services in the state. And then we moved into a period when they moved the Older Blind Federal Program from being what we call a discretionary grant, meaning that agencies had to apply for it and compete for it, into being what is known as a formula grant, which means that every state gets the grant based on their population. And when they did that, because of the timing of when Congress did that, we got double funding 1 year for that. We spread that out over 3 years, which was as long as possible, so that we could continue to serve as many individuals. And then you'll see when we got to 2003, we are now down to just having the single older blind grant, and so that's why we've had the decrease in that program through the years. The next performance measure is the cost per client in the Older Blind Program. And this cost is really just taking the total amount that we receive in that grant and dividing it by the total number served. So when we serve more individuals, the cost tends to go down. But as you'll see, we are in the $500 range usually. But when you go back and you compare that to the $50,000 a year to have someone in a nursing home, you see the size of savings that providing these services can provide for an individual. We have a goal in that program of serving individuals within 45 days of referral so that we aren't creating too long of a wait list. The next performance measure is relative to our business enterprise program, which is the food service vending. And this should be average gross revenue, not growth, on that chart. And you'll see that this is the gross revenue per unit per year. Last year we were at $117,000 approximately for our units. Then the next page is really the links to the Oregon benchmarks.
Representative Hanna.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it growth revenue or gross revenue?
It's gross.
It is gross revenue.
Yes, okay. Sorry. Yeah. That was a typo that we didn't catch until we'd already printed them up, and I was going through it, and I'm like, what is growth revenue?
And you're doing very well.
Yeah, that would have been very well, yes. We wish that were what it were.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry about that. Any other questions on that? Really, that concludes our performance measures, and then we have a sheet on page 32 which shows the links to the Oregon benchmarks. And then on page 33, we describe how we use this information within the agency. We really have been doing a lot of management analysis of our performance measures And I have given a few examples here of some of the changes and resulting actions that we have taken. We have shifted resources to our case service budget whenever possible to reduce the wait time for services, because we cannot open an individual's case if we don't have the case service money that would be required to serve them. We also have established a new position within the agency to enhance our business relations. As I mentioned, we view business as a customer of our agency, and we view helping them maintain and employ blind individuals to be one of the services that we can provide them. And we never have had anyone really targeted to work with businesses. So we created a new position who is working specifically with businesses to really enhance that relationship, so we understand what businesses need, and also to let them know who we are and that we are available to provide services to them should some of their employees lose vision and they want to maintain them. We want them to know we're a resource. We also have shifted our teaching resources to eliminate the wait time for our training center. And we had a really exciting partnership this year with a consumer organization, the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon, to provide older blind independent living seminars. And this was a model where we did an intensive 5-day training with seniors in the older blind program that was actually funded through donations from the NFB of Oregon. And we were able to very effectively serve a number of individuals in that program, and we plan to repeat and do another seminar this May. I'm going to ask Don to go over our strategic planning activities.
Before you do that, could you clarify something for me?
Sure.
Okay, I'm looking at four pages. First is page 6, which says historical growth, and it says for 2004, consumers served in the VR, I assume that's Voc Rehab, right?
Mm-hmm.
Program. It says 914 or 906. I guess it's 906.
Mm-hmm.
And then on page 24, it says number of blind individuals served in Voc Rehab Program, 850.
Oh, that's, Chair Richardson, the 850 was the target that we established prior to last biennium. The 906 is the column before it, which should match the chart on page 6.
Okay, and now I'm looking at page 32, and I'm looking at targets of 850. And then I'm looking at page 60, and it says Voc Rehab client characteristics, age breakdown by opening cases, and it says total of 718 cases.
What page is that?
Page 60.
Okay, let me go and just look at it so I'm in and see what I get. Oh, that this is the individual of the number that were closed in 2004. And I don't see the total number. Let me look at the total. Are you looking at the secondary disabilities?
I'm looking on page 60, the very bottom. It says total of 718 cages.
Oh, okay.
Cases.
Yeah, I'm wondering what year that is for. I will have to check into that and get back to you. Oh, I'm sorry. My staff just explained it to me. That's the open cases that are currently open at the time that we did this. We were just trying to look at what is the average age of individuals that we're serving. So Okay. Those were individuals that were open, which we define as after we determine their eligibility, we develop a plan, and then when we begin services. So these are individuals who have gotten to the point where we actually have begun services.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that clarify that for you?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just, this is just a thought. Most of what I've done, what you've done that I can tell, for instance, on page 6, you're taking the line item for whatever that might be, the VR program, dividing it by the number of people served in the program. But you might also consider that whatever percentage of that program is, you would take the same percentage of overhead and apply it to that so that you get, you know, certainly you have overhead that applies to that program, I would suspect. I mean, it looks like your program costs are really great for the most part, but I would apply some of that overhead as well. I mean, for instance, if you're going to use vocational rehab, it's 52% of your budget. So if you came down and said, what's 52% of our administrative services on top of that program? Would that be fair to allocate some of that overhead to the program? just as a, if we're looking at total cost, you can't get away from that administrative piece.
Right,
that might be a fair way to allocate it against
Chair Richardson,
the
Representative Hannon. Yeah, that would be, if you're looking at the overall cost, and that is what we do with the older blind, but we've been using with the VR program the traditional measures that have been required by the Rehab Services Administration, and they look at the direct case cost. So you're right, there is additional cost which isn't measured in that amount, which would be the overhead costs for each case, yeah.
Please continue.
Okay. Okay. We'll go back to page 34, which is our strategic plan. And these are the priorities that we have established in conjunction with the Commission Board for the agency. They're really pretty much our goals. We want to increase our average wage at closure. We want to increase the average percentage of individuals above poverty level at closure. We want to be able to maintain our technology services. Increase employment through the Older Worker Initiative. We had a special initiative looking at the older population who might be interested in employment and making sure that they're offered that opportunity. We also are interested in enhancing self-employment. Self-employment is the successful closure within our program, and it's something that we have been training staff on and helping individuals to develop self-employment plans. We also think it's very important that we maintain the services in our rural areas of the state. We want to increase the diversity of the clients that we serve to make sure we are meeting all of the populations within the state. And we also are interested in expanding our transition services through strong partnerships with education. And we want to continue to maintain the older blind individuals' independence in their homes and their communities. On page 35, did you want to do the guiding principles? Or?
Oh, go ahead.
You'll see the guiding principles that the board worked in conjunction with the management of the agency to develop and really use these when we were prioritizing the services of the agency. Our first principle was to identify what services contribute most to the agency mission, which is the employment and independence of blind Oregonians. Then to look at cost effectiveness and return on investment to the state. Then we have a guiding principle of leveraging our state funds to bring in the full federal funds that are available, because we feel that not doing so is a tremendous loss of funds to the state, which are dedicated really for us to have available and we know we can effectively use. The fourth principle was to maintain the investment that special education has made in youth transitioning from school by continuing to serve them until they reach employment, and hence the emphasis that we have placed on that transition program. The overall principles that the commission came up with was that the commission is the only statewide program that teaches newly blinded Oregonians adaptive living skills to prevent the need for placement in more restrictive and costly settings. We provide a
Senator Moss Anderson.
Do you know, this is Lori Moss Anderson from the Gresham area. Do you know of how many blind people are being placed in nursing homes at this point in time?
Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, I don't have that information.
In your presentation, you're always comparing to nursing homes as compared to assisted living or adult foster or other alternatives, which are less expensive than $50,000 a year.
Right.
And would you know of anyone who would be tracking that? Would nursing homes or would the agency that oversees the assisted livings have that information? Do you know?
Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, I'm not sure that they're tracking it by disability. I think there's some like statistical kinds of averages that we could come up with, but if you would like me to research that, I would be happy to do that and get it back to you.
At this point, I wouldn't want you to go to all that trouble, but I do think it's an element that you should keep in the back of your mind so that it might be helpful information.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice to know if our blind population is truly growing at what rate it is growing in the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think there is just the inescapable fact that macular degeneration is in most cases an age specific condition, and of course as our population ages in general, and of course this is not unique to Oregon, it's inevitable that we're going to see an increase in the number of people with that particular condition.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Okay. And then, of course, we pointed another principle that we use relative to the Elder Blind Program is that it does enjoy a 9-to-1 federal match for funding. The next page is the 10% reduction options that we developed should we be required to take the reductions, and we used the principles that we had just outlined on the page before. And then we also identified our agency-wide priorities. That really concludes my phase one presentation. Are there any questions? And are you ready for us to then move into phase two?
We are ready.
And I believe that we were going to have Valentina from our budget management analyst begin the phase two presentation.
Good morning.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
You'll need to pull a microphone.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me? Good morning. My name is Valentina Fomenko. I'm with the Budget and Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. What I'm going to do today is basically give a very brief overview of the agency's budget to provide context for the more detailed budget discussion that Ms. Malk is going to be presenting in just a few minutes. And this is our first phase two presentation. This is a new experience for us, and I would very much appreciate any suggestions or requests if there is any additional information that BAM can provide to help you in the future. That would be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Just a moment, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. This is our first phase two presentation too, so we're pretty excited about finally getting here also.
Thank you. Let's start on page two, and this slide just puts things into perspective. Commission for the Blind is within the Human Services program area, and this is a very significant program area within the state budget. It accounts for about 20% of the total state spending. When you look at the share of the commission, it's less than 1% in total funds, and that's the chart on the left side of the slide. And the chart on the right side shows the commission's share in distribution of general and lottery funds, and again, it's less than 1%. And I just wanted to point out that the total funds. Are about $13.4 million with the Commission for the Blind, and general fund is about $1.2 million. As you remember, the governor grouped programs in six principles, core principles that are related to the organ's long-term future. And the entire commission's budget is placed in the principle related to education. Turning to page four, this slide shows how the commission is financed. And again, as you see, 72% of the agency's budget comes from federal sources, and it's primarily under the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And as Ms. Moffat has already pointed out, the commission enjoys a very favorable match rate about 79 to 21% in most programs, and in the older blind program, it's about 10% state funds to 90% federal funds. Another large source of funds is various other fund sources. The most important source of other funds is contracts with counties, Multnomah counties, and Clackamas County. These contracts bring about $1.1 million per biennium. And finally, general fund appropriation in the governor's recommended budget is about $1.2 million. The next slide, page five, shows program units within the agency. And Ms. Mock has already talked about all of them, but I just wanted to point out that, again, the bulk of the spending in the agency happens in the rehabilitative services program, 63% total funds, and other programs take much less funding, and finally administrative services take about 10% total spending.
Could you clarify something for me?
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at page 2 and then again at page 4. On page 2, on the right side, it says general funds and lottery funds, $2.5 million. And then on page 4, it says general funds, 9%. And I thought you said that the governor's recommended budget for general funds was $1.2 million. I'm a little confused.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I probably did not explain the first slide very well. This shows program area information. So this chart shows the total for the entire human services program area, and this is $2,516 million.
Zeros. Okay, got it. I see.
Okay, and I'm turning back to page 6, and now let's talk about spending categories for the Commission for the Blind, and the largest portion of the budget is spent in personal services, and this is basically staffing costs for the 47 agency employees, 44% of the total budget. 32% is spent in services and supplies, and these are business operational costs, such as office supplies, travel expenses, rent and maintenance, and a lot of other similar expenses. Capital outlay, about 1%, this category funds purchases that are typically technology-related equipment or other higher cost expenditures that have a useful life of more than 5 years.
A question.
Mm-hmm. Senator Moss Anderson.
On that chart on page 6, personal services or personnel services? Is it personal services?
Mr. Chair, Senator, these are budget categories, and this is a standard name for this budget category. Personal services includes salaries, benefits, and all other personnel-related services. So these are basically the same. It's just this is the way we call them.
Yeah, I'm used to having it titled personnel rather than personal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, special payments are about 23% of the entire budget, and it's a fairly significant portion, and it's important to the agency because this is direct payments to clients for purchases of equipment or services that are necessary as clients go through the program. Page 7, this table shows the changes in agency spending over time, started in 1999-01 biennium, all the way through the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget. There are just two critical pieces of information I wanted to emphasize here. First is a overall decrease in general fund appropriation compared to the 1901 biennium. And the significant cut was taken in 2003-05. Another issue here is a very, very significant increase in the use of other funds. And finally, federal funds, there is a steady increase in the use of federal funds. So what this means is that in order to provide the matching rate to secure all available federal funds, the agency has been relying more and more on using other funds instead of general fund. Major policy issues for the agency and Ms. Mock has already talked a lot about them. First, there is increased demand for services, especially among the population of older Oregonians. There's not enough state resources available to provide all services to all eligible clients, so the agency entered the order of selection in August of 2000. And as I mentioned, in the 2003-2005 biennium, the agency took a significant cut in its general fund appropriation. And again, because of the very beneficial federal fund matching rate, that would some kind of solution had to be found to secure that federal funding. So what was done was that the agency turned to other funds and used the parts of its donations fund to provide as a match for federal dollars. The agency at the same time lost 7 permanent positions and reduced some of other positions, so it all accounted to 8.0 FTE. And as a result, some positions were restored, but as a result, the agency suffered, incurred problems with recruiting for some of those positions because of the limited duration nature of those positions that were stored.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What year did you say that cut happened?
It happened during the 2003 legislative session.
In general fund, in general fund, I don't see much of a difference there from the 2001-2003 to the 2003-2005. Less than $50,000, so I wouldn't think it was too many positions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, and you're correct. This doesn't look like a significant cut. However, if you consider the matching rate for the federal dollars, that automatically translates into a significant cut.
Would you tell us why it was? If you look at the total funds, there actually was an increase between 2001-2003 and 2003-2005, and then a loss of 7 permanent positions. What would justify, or what required the loss of 7 positions when the overall funding did increase?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that some of the positions were restored on a limited duration basis.
Okay.
And at the same time, and the rest of the money was channeled to special payments budget category and channeled directly to clients.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Clarification, Ms. Monte.
The agency appeared at the November 2003 emergency board and had funding restored. The cut Ms. Minka is referring to happened at the adopted budget level. The agency went back and decided then to use its donation and bequest funds, returned to the November emergency board, and had that restored. The dollar cut. They only restored a few of the positions, however, that they lost. They're currently using limited durations in the current biennium.
Oh, I see. All right, so positions, FTEs were cut, but actual people at the desks did not significantly change. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, about 7 positions were cut during the session, and later during the biennium, about half of those positions were stored on a limited duration basis. So, to answer your question, the actual people on at the desk actually did change. That number did change.
Okay, thank you. Just for the committee's clarification, make sure that I understand this.
Right.
What I understand is that you had funds in reserve from donations from other sources, and that you ended up lessening the negative effects of the 2003-2005 budget by choosing to free up some of those funds which then were matched by federal dollars and increased your overall funding. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Could I follow up?
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would the case be that those funds flowed back into their general fund dollars? Is that where those would have come to? Or where would we...
Why should I ask? We have our able advisor here.
I think that part of the confusion is when you compare the actuals that were showing in 0103 to the approved budget, there's not a big reduction in general fund. And I think in some ways it's the cut that they took a large cut in general fund during session. I think their actual spending in 0103 was less than it was budgeted to be in general fund, and so we're comparing actual expenditures to a budgeted amount, which is why it looks odd, because it's only like a $49,000 difference between what they actually spent in 0103 and what the 0305 budgeted amount for general fund is.
This legislatively approved, which is different than legislatively adopted, the legislatively approved number for general funds, does that include the amount of funds that were transferred from the reserves of the commission?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they would show up in the other funds category. They wouldn't be spent as general fund. They're backfilling a general fund loss with the other funds.
Okay. So it actually show up in the other funds number?
Correct. Okay. And I believe you see that increase across that line.
Okay. May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be important for us to know what that number is.
Which number?
What the backfill number is. How much was it?
How much was freed up from your reserves?
If memory serves around $180,000. $140,000. Thank you, Mike.
Okay, $140,000, and then that was matched at a... So that was like 2 point something percent.
Yeah.
So you got a huge match on
like $800,000 in general.
Yeah.
Or something
okay.
Like
yeah.
Yes.
All right. Please continue.
And finally, the only policy package for the governor's recommended budget tries to address this, to some extent mitigate the consequences of this cut. It still relies on the use of donations. Funds to provide for federal to as a match for federal dollars. However, it restores some of the positions to permanent status, and one of those positions is a part-time clerical support position to serve as at the front desk of the agency's headquarters in Portland, and three positions are. Rehabilitation provide the rehabilitation services, direct services to clients. This is critical for the agency to be able to fulfill its mission.
Okay. Now, are you saying that the request for additional FTEs is to make permanent positions that are presently being filled by part-time or whatever would be the
limited duration?
By
limited duration staff?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, did you also say that there is in this proposed budget, I assume it would be in the other funds category, additional funds coming from the Commission's reserves?
Mr. Chair, yes. This package relies on the entire amount being transferred from the donations fund.
Okay, my recollection was that amount was $700,000+. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I do not think this is
it's
the correct amount.
In the materials here, I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I went through it.
I believe that is the projected ending balance in the donation fund for the current biennium.
Okay, this is ending balance for current biennium, and that total amount is being included in the governor's recommended budget?
It's in the revenue section, Mr. Chair. The expenditure amount, they're only proposing to spend a portion of that amount in 0507. There's a projected ending balance for the donation and bequest fund of
About 7,000.
Sure. How much would be the projected ending balance from that?
730,000.
Okay. Do you recall then what the actual amount of the reserves are anticipated to be spent in the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, this number is around $200,000.
Okay, so just so I can have this clear, we have over 700 now. We're going to end up with 700, and there's going to be 200 spent. Is it expected then that there will be roughly 200,000 that comes in during the next biennium, and then it's going to be going out, or do I have the numbers wrong?
Mr. Chair, the donations fund is somewhat volatile source of revenue for the agency. There is a healthy ending balance in it right now. However, it's not expected that this amount of money is going to be deposited in this fund. The agency expects about $25,000 in new revenues to this fund over the 2005-07 biennium. Maybe just trying to answer your question. I think the question is, we are going to be draining down the donations fund.
Okay. Samantha, do you have any more specifics?
And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to provide you in the subcommittee the actual numbers that work through that. But Valentina is correct that the agency's budget assumes that they will continue to whittle down the donation and bequest funds, and at the rate they're currently invested in spending it, it'll last them another 6 years or so at the current rate. But they are spending it down. They haven't budgeted to spend it all, but they will continue to spend that down as long as it lasts. And if I could just clarify a little bit about the policy package, and is simply formalizing what they had approved in the November 2003 emergency board. It's not new. In terms of program or enhancing it, just shores up what they actually got in November of 2003 so that it can continue on.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the donated other funds category include the 11% that comes back from the vending and spending the enterprise fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no, it does not.
Other questions before we continue? All right, please continue, Valentina.
This is all I had for this morning, and this is a very brief overview again. And now I'm going to turn it to Ms. Mock for a more detailed presentation.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation.
I do have one question.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to go back to the budget categories that you had on page 6. Ordinarily, usually personnel expenses are usually 80% of the budget for an agency. And I'm wondering why the Commission on Blind is different, where you have some just a smaller percentage going to FTE and then a much greater percentage in services supply and special payments. And if you could explain a little bit more again, maybe you said it, but I don't know what the special payments and services and supplies are covering. I think you said services and supplies is mileage and paper.
Ms. Mock?
Yeah, I can respond to that. Chair Richardson and Senator Magnus Anderson, the special payments is direct purchases that we make for clients. So they're not actually payments to the clients, but, you know, we for example, said that we purchase technology. We send people for medical services, counseling services. We help people with further education. All of those are considered special payments. And you're right, that is large compared to most agencies in general, and it's because of the nature of the rehabilitation program where we are actually, you know, spending direct payments on our clients.
Just follow up on that. Then every client who gets a special payment, do you take into account their income at all, or are these usually unemployed people, or I would just, do you have a fee base or a sliding fee scale?
Chair Richardson and Senator Montes-Anderson, we do not have what's called, what you're calling it, which is a needs test for our services. It is possible to have one under the Rehabilitation Act for some services but not for others. And because of the nature of our population, most of them, in fact, are unemployed. In fact, the majority of them are on Social Security benefits, either SSI or SSDI. So we really did an analysis, and based on the percentage of individuals who would be able to contribute to their plan, if we required, did a needs assessment, it's so small that it wouldn't really administratively cover the cost of trying to do that kind of analysis. When you get to the cost containment things that we have done within the agency, we do encourage individuals to participate in the cost, and they can voluntarily participate in the cost of their plan, but we cannot require them to without formally going into this needs assessment. And because such a high percentage wouldn't qualify just because of the fact that they're on Social Security benefits, we haven't done that. We do, however, encourage individuals to purchase some of the smaller items, like in the Older Blind Program, most of the individuals would purchase their own magnifiers, those kinds of things. And when we get into the larger ticket items, which are mostly the adaptive computer type of things that are in the Voc Rehab Program, typically we do provide that, although we also encourage businesses to provide them under reasonable accommodation within the ADA.
Pay for TTYs or not? No, what is it? Anything to do with communication? Like, I don't know what types of services that you actually need on an ongoing monthly basis, or just these are just special one-time items.
Because of the nature of the program being a time-limited program, typically most of our expenditures would be one-time expenditures if they're equipment. Now, we might have some ongoing expenses. For example, if we have an individual who is going to college as a part of their rehabilitation program, we would look at similar benefits, we call them, so that they would then be getting, perhaps a Pell Grant and some of those kinds of funding that are available for education. But they might need reader services, is one that we typically have provided. And that could be an ongoing service during the time that their case is open. But when they are determined rehabilitated in our language, which is 90 days at least of employment, then we would terminate all of those kinds of payments. So there are some that tend to be, over a period of time, but a lot of them are one-time purchases of equipment.
So a person who's going to college, they can afford to go to college, but they are able to access the interpreter or the reader services through the Commission for the Blind, basically.
Yeah, if someone is in college, what we do is we use the same economic criteria. This is sort of a little bit of an exception that you've picked up on to not having a needs assessment. But we are required that they apply for all financial aid that they are eligible for. And if under the analysis that's done, really we don't do it ourselves. It's done by the financial aid offices of the institutions, the colleges, community colleges, universities. If it's determined that there's an expected family contribution, that would be a part of their contribution to the tuition based on the family income, then they are expected to make that contribution. So we don't supplant that. We're trying to level the playing field. So we are trying to give them the additional services that they would need to be able to function independently. For example, a lot of blind people would use a portable device where they can input Braille and take notes in a classroom. It's a fairly expensive device. It costs about $5,000. So we would typically provide that for a college student. But if there's an expected family contribution, that would be determined by the financial aid office of the school that they're attending, then the family would make that. And most of the individuals, as I said, that we have, if they're adults, a lot of them are on benefits, so they automatically would qualify for Pell and that sort of thing. If they're from a family and they're a transitioning youth, they would be looked at like any other Oregonian in the state.
And then the services and the supplies, again, that seems like a high number. But, I don't want to micromanage. I just
Chair Richardson and Senator Mona Sanderson, I'm not quite sure how it compares with other agencies, but one of the things that is included there is our in-state travel, and we have a very itinerant-based staff. As I said, in our Older Blind program, we go into the homes of the individuals, and we provide services in their homes, so that may account for some of that, because that does include that category. I think probably our use of paper and that sort of thing would be comparable to any other agencies.
Okay, thank you. Deborah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also just wanted to point out that about 1.4, almost 1.5 million of that SNS number is the Industries for the Blind program.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That runs through their SNS budget, even though it's not, it's paying for people and rent. So it's just an odd placement in the budget for that.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. If we want to proceed with my phase two section, it starts on page 38, where we look at what are some of the budget-driving environmental factors that we have been dealing with. I think we've talked about a lot of these, so I'm going to go over them quickly, and I'm going to try not repeat the information that Valentina has provided for you.
Okay, before we do that, we have 35 minutes left, and so how should we spend that time?
Well, would you like to go really to talking about what the agency request was and our priorities? And
I have several questions on your performance measures.
Okay, well, why don't we? I think it would make sense to deal with the questions that you have and then see what time we've got left.
All right, then let's turn to the back of the book under appendix. Starting with page 73, and I'm looking at various performance measures, and I'm looking at trends. And so on page 73, the performance measure is percentage of successful closures in vocational rehabilitation programs. And in 2000, it was 83%. In 01, it was 74%. In 02, 71%. In 03, 60%. Can you explain why we have a trend going down like that in closures?
Yes, Chair Richardson, that was really a period when we were experiencing a very high unemployment rate within Oregon. In fact, we had the highest unemployment rate in the nation, which did impact our ability to place people into employment. Additionally, we went into an order of selection in the year 2000. Now, an order of selection, I haven't described in a lot of detail, and I was going to under the driving factors, and I think I'll explain it to you here so that you'll understand the impact on our outcomes. Order of selection is required under the Rehabilitation Act if you don't have adequate resources to serve everyone who's eligible, and we found ourselves in that position. When that happens, we are required to set up kind of a priority category of three categories of individuals we served, and we must serve the individuals with the most significant disabilities first. So at the point that we do the eligibility determination to see if they, in fact, are eligible for services at all, the council would place them either in the category of an individual with the most significant disabilities, an individual with significant disabilities, or an individual with disabilities. And we must serve all of the individuals in the most significant disability category before we can serve or open individuals in the other two categories. And part of the definition of being an individual with the most significant disability is that you have more barriers to employment, that you require more services over a longer period of time.
Now, this would always be the case, right? I mean, that's always the situation that you would be categorizing services based on level of severity.
Yeah, but under the order selection, you must serve individuals first who have the most significant, regardless of the time of application. So for a fairly long period of time, we were only able to serve the category ones for us as most significant disabled. So you are really serving a population that takes longer to rehabilitate, takes longer to move through the system, is more difficult to place in employment, and in fact costs more to rehabilitate.
Okay, now see, the confusion I'm having is that would always be the case, that you'd always have to serve those with the greatest disabilities, whether it was 10 years ago or 2 years ago. Is that not correct?
Chair Richardson, no. In the past, if we're not in an order of selection, anyone who is eligible for our services would move into a plan and we would serve them. To be eligible for our services, they had to be legally blind and they had to have a barrier that would require services and want to work, those things we told you about. But to be an individual with the most significant disabilities, the definition we have says that they have to be affected in at least three functional areas. So they would they have more significant disabilities. There is, I mean, yes, they're all disabled, so they would all be in one of the three categories, but based on an assessment that would be done of the skills that they have and the barriers that they have and the length of time that it would take.
Because of time, I'm going to kind of cut you off because we're going to have to, I want to get to the point. I must be not clear on changes that must have occurred because it would seem to me that you're going to be making those kinds of decisions every year. You have limited resources. You have a limited. You're going to work with those who have the greatest needs, unless there was a change in criteria.
Chair Richardson, there wasn't a change in criteria, but what there was a really an increase. As you saw, our population is growing. And so what happened is our population grew to where we didn't have enough resources to serve everyone that was eligible. So we had to kind of tighten the eligibility, if you want to look at it that way. We still say they're eligible, but then we say we can't serve you now. We're going to put you on a wait list until we serve everyone who has a higher level of disability. So there actually was a change, and it was really a change in the resources that we had available. And within the vocational rehabilitation program, the federal regulations and law require that you can't create waiting lists without going into this prioritization first.
Okay, I do.
Does that answer your question?
Well, it's an answer, but I'm looking back at your funding, and I saw that the funding increased every biennium, and so I'm not real clear on why.
Chair Richardson, if you look at the funding increases, there really are a cost of living increase was essentially what happened to us through those years. So we were given a federal cost of living, which we were able to match with state and other. So it's around 3.2% that was increased.
Right.
But the population growth has been greater than that, as have some of the expenses that are related. With like our technology costs have gone up more than the 3%.
Okay, so I'm back on page 4 or 6, where we've had your graph on population increase.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking from 2000 to 2004, and I see an increase of 21 people being served from 885 to 906. Mm-hmm. And so with, you know, and we're dealing with nearly 1,000 people, a 20.
Very small.
That's a very small increase. Okay, well, so anyway, I haven't got a real clear answer, but I'd like to now take you over to page, let's see. We were on, 73. Let's go two pages up to 75. And this says number of successful rehabilitation closures for the federal fiscal year, and in 2001 it was 128, in 2002 is 107, in 2003 is 85. And so can you help me understand why we have a trend going down for closing cases? Is it because of the severity of the cases again, or is there other factors?
Chair Richardson, it's partly because of that, but it's also because of what was happening within the state at that point. We had a very high unemployment rate in Oregon. In fact, we had the highest unemployment rate in the nation for
the successful closure rate.
Successful closures are definitely related to what's happening overall in the economy, because we are placing individuals, in Oregon in businesses. So that is, and you'll see that for 2004, which isn't on this chart, it has improved, and we are hoping that that trend will continue.
What is for 2004?
You know, we had it earlier. I think it was
109.
All right, that helps. The next page talks about number of served in summer work experience programs. And again, we have, from 01, 03, this diminished. Can you tell me what the number would be for 04?
You know, we have those. I'm going to have to flip back to our performance measure. You'll see there's a green tab. And I think you might have had to step out.
Yeah, we've got that number. So what do we have for 04?
58.
58. Okay. So trend is coming back up.
Yes, it
is. All of their measures. You can
And I think we did have a number of factors, which we were going to get to in the driving, but I'll jump to them now, that were affecting our performance. And one of them we have talked around about a little bit, where we did lose a number of positions. We were able to restore about half of them with limited duration positions. Some of them were difficult to fill, and so we had some vacancies. We also had a lot of retirements that took place within the agency. We actually had 20% of our staff retire, and when you lose experienced counselors who have, you know, been performing at a certain level and you have new individuals, there was a drop-off, and I think it was partly attributed to that. There were just a lot of factors that sort of convened on that. But I think we are bouncing back.
Okay, because of time, I want to continue on. Were there any of those that retired, rehired on a part-time or non-FTE basis?
Chair Richardson, we do have a couple of our administrative staff that are working on a part-time basis, but we have now, the good news is that we have now filled the limited duration positions that we have, which are really, if you look at the policy package that we're requesting, we are requesting that those be made into permanent positions, and they are currently filled, and so I think that's going to help our performance continue.
Are any of your staff retired PERS members that are now receiving retirement and the pay that you give them?
Chair Richardson, I think we have a couple of clerical staff that are working part-time who are retired. But we don't have any of our direct service staff. Basically, you know, they left, and we were able eventually to hire new people into those positions.
Okay, on page 80, it's the cost per client in the older blind program. I think that for, am I correct, at 04 it's $500? Mm-hmm. Is that?
I think it was, I'll have to go back and look at, I apologize. Let's see, it's on page 29. If you go back, you'll see it there. And for 2004, it was $570.
Okay, 2004 is $570. Is that what you have also? What are you looking at, Deborah?
I have 648, but that could be my that would be my error. I'll verify that for you.
Okay, we'll verify it. I'm looking at what the cost, the increase in cost per client causes are from. 01, it was 436, 02, 454, 03, 584, and then 04, 570. So there's a substantial increase in the cost per client for the older blind program. I'm wondering if you could explain that.
Chair Richardson, I think the explanation for that is that the way we arrive at that is that we take the total number of the budget, and we divide it by the total number served, and we serve less individuals, partly due to some of the turnover we talked about. We have, in the older blind program, just to put it in perspective for you, we have 6 instructors, and we had a vacancy for over a year in one of those positions, and so we had a couple of vacancies that occurred that really affected the number that we served, and so when you divide that total, it makes the cost per individual go up.
Okay, so the increase from 800 and whatever it was, 885 in 2000 to 906 now does not reflect an increase in this one population. That increase is actually going down?
The 906 is individuals served in the vocational rehabilitation program.
That category.
That's only that category. The older buying is completely separate funding, and so we have, you know, a separate count for the individuals served in that program.
And that has diminished.
That has diminished somewhat. If you look at page 29, back where I had my performance measures, it's really the same information we use, but just kind of made a little larger and probably easier to read. You'll see that, and we have had some variation in this program, and again, it's based on largely how much funding we had available for it. We have had some grants that have come in and out through the years, and then we had some vacancies in the program in 2003, and so I think we increased, you know, in 2004 slightly based on being able to fill the positions that we had.
Okay. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reference to this, coming up with a number for cost per client served, if you'd reference page 6, which is a graph showing the number of folks in the vocational rehab program, and then I believe, again, page 24, very similar in terms of what they say.
Mm-hmm.
You show an average cost per case of $22.57 on 9. Can you talk about how you came to that number?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, yes, I can. That number is arrived at when we were looking at the special payments portion of our budget. Special payments are the direct expenditures that we make on clients, and that is the average of those direct expenditures that we make. We report this to the Rehab Services Administration for the federal part of the program, and that's just, you know, the actual expenses. It doesn't include the staff expenses. It doesn't include the overhead.
So this follow-up, please. So the $2,257 is just for the special payments portion?
That's correct.
So you're not using the slightly under $7 million number and coming to that?
That's correct.
So tell me which number you are using again.
Well, it would be based on the special payments. It would be what we do is we took the average that we spent per client. We actually track that on an individual basis with the clients that we serve, so we know for each individual what the expenditures are. And then we report that to our federal partner, Rehab Services Administration. So that number is based on the average for the clients that were served in that year.
So we can't take that graph that shows special payment and divide by the number of folks served and come up with this number?
Right, no.
Yeah. Just a follow-up.
Sure.
That's difficult. It's difficult to have, and I've said this in other budget-type meetings, where we cannot track back to a number that you want us to advocate for. If we can't get back to it, it makes it very difficult. And my recommendation on that, and this is just me and dealing with numbers, if you're going to give us the number, show us how to get there. That's, I think, critically important.
Okay, you've answered my questions. I now turn back. Other questions at this point? If not, then areas you'd like to have us focus on?
Well, I'm just going to look through quickly here. I think we've covered a lot of the performance measure information already, so we probably don't need to repeat that. If we look at the budget drivers, we've also talked about a lot of those. I guess I would like to point to page 41, to the cost containment strategies that we have used within the agency to try to increase our outcomes and reduce our cost per client. We have invoked our order of selection. We now monitor and have to only open new cases as funds lie. We make maximum use of the comparable benefits that might be available. We are asking employers to increase their contributions for technology and reasonable accommodation. We encourage clients to participate in costs when it's feasible. We have developed some web-based instruction to follow up on the technology instruction that we provide so that it's available throughout the state. We also have used peer mentors who provide technical assistance on adaptive technology. We have restructured our orientation and career center so that we are able to serve individuals in group classes and move the individuals more quickly through that program. And we have also received some technical assistance grants from the Rehab Services Administration to help with some of our technology services. I think maybe we should skip now to page 46, which talks about some of the budget issues that we are facing. Since 1990, our VR caseload has increased about 270%, and since 1996, our technology costs have increased by 94%. Which is a significant issue for us as you look at a budget which has increased, by the cost of living.
Can you explain why they would have gone up so much when other technology has actually come down dramatically in the last 10 years?
Chair Richardson, there's a couple of factors, and I think that the cost of technology for specialized technology has also come down, but what has happened is the prevalence of the need for it in the work situation has dramatically increased. And so previously, when we first got adaptive technology available, the main people that were using it were pretty much people who were computer programmers and computer analysts, people that were working in the computer business. Now, almost everyone needs to have access to technology on their job, and so it's just increased so that it's a very common service now that we are providing, and it didn't used to be that in the past. We have increased the use of our donated funds to continue what we consider to be our mission-critical functions and to allow us to continue to match the federal allotment that is available to us. And we have shifted the savings that we've had in administrative areas into our case services, which is the special payments that you saw, so that we can move more individuals into being served. And we do, of course, have a very favorable federal match. We also have a maintenance of effort requirement within the Rehab Act, which requires that if we... they do a two-year rolling average of the non-federal contribution, and if that decreases, then we are penalized for that in the future. On page 47, I won't spend much time on this because I think Valentina also provided you this information, but it shows you the increase in the budget through the years and also the fact that we have had a decrease in the number of FTE. The next few pages have already been covered, but I think the point is that we have about 9% of our budget as general fund, 72% is federal, and we have 19% other. The development process, I think Valentina has covered with you. I guess I would like to skip to page 53.
The talk 51.
Did you want to talk about 51?
Please.
I have another question. It just took me a while to get here.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A 270% increase since 1990. That would indicate 18% growth annually. Yet, from 96 to 04, your growth rate is around 4.8%. So from 90 to 96, you had to have incredibly large growth. Can you document that?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I believe we can. I mean, we have a... the numbers year by year, and that's just the average percentage that occurred during that period. It's on page 6, I believe. Does that answer your question?
Maybe take a second. Can you explain why there was such a huge growth from 336 in 1990 to 885 and a decade later?
Well, I think
these are people in the program,
yeah.
People graduating out of the program. And
right, this is, Chair Richardson, this is individuals in the program. And I think that, you know, part of it is if we looked at Oregon's population has grown, and we reflect, the percentage of individuals who have a disability reflects the overall population, of course.
We're talking about over 150%.
Yeah, I think the other factor is that we are an aging population, and we are seeing the leading causes of blindness tend to be age-related, and so we're seeing an increase as we age, and we are also seeing an increase in the number of individuals who are wanting to work after what we had considered to be retirement age, and that population tends to have a higher incidence of blindness. I guess that would be my best shot at trying to give you an explanation.
Okay. Do you have any other follow-up at this point?
Well, that is very difficult to see how. I mean, the question in my mind probably goes more along the lines of, are we reporting something completely different than to say we had that kind of a jump from, for instance, 95 to 96, I just can't imagine there was this population of people out there, and then all of a sudden, bingo, there was double that population that quickly. It just statistically doesn't seem possible that they were there one day and the next, or 1 year and the next year, they weren't. And I'm wondering if it's a reporting issue rather than a number.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, I actually have worked for the agency during that period of time, and I don't think we have changed some reporting things that we have done through the years, but I don't believe that is one of them. I think that we have some factors where if you looked, we have focused our And I think it might have to do with the thing that Chair Richardson was getting at earlier, which is outreach. And one of the things that we have really focused on is trying to get most of our resources into our direct service staff. So when we have more counselors, they're going to identify more people in the community. And one area that we have really focused on, and probably I'd have to go back and try to correlate the dates to see if it was during this time, was transition services, where we are trying to have a strong program of serving youth who are exiting the school system. And so we are, if you looked at our population that we're serving, we have a fair percentage of them that are fairly young, and they stay in the system for a long time because of the fact that they are not yet finished many times with their high school education when we begin serving them. So I think that accounts for it, because I think we set our average period of time that someone has served is 3.4 years. But if you looked up for transition youth, I don't have that number. I could get it for you, but it's substantially longer than that. So some of those individuals are staying in the system longer, which I think does account for it. And it might be that we got some of our cooperative agreements with education during those years, and that would account for some of that jump.
Okay, really the more relevant to our discussion now is what's happened in recent years. And so I look at 2000, I see 885, and 2004, 906. And so
it's more of a gradual.
21, that's about 2.4% increase in the last 4 years. So the caseload increasing 270% in the last 14 years is not as relevant as a 2.4% increase in the last 4 years. So anyway, but...
Yes, Chair Richardson, I would agree with that, yeah. We were just giving the historical perspective there of, where the agency has been.
This is not under historical page. This is under budget issues.
Yeah.
So this means the things affecting the budget today.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's all right. It's okay to, it's our job to kind of bore down on a little bit. I have a question on page 51. This is actually the budget. So now, now I just need to make sure I understand it. And so I'm looking at the 0507 base budget, which would be the 0305 legislatively approved budget plus e-board of 12,659,000 plus essential packages of 795,000. Would you define that for me, essential packages?
Yes. Chair Richardson, if you'll turn to page 52, the essential packages are outlined there.
Okay.
These are things that are essentially required of the agency as we go through the process for the governor's recommended budget. So we had personal service adjustments of 234,000 approximately.
Okay. Personal service, that means pay increases and benefit cost increases?
I believe that's what that means, yes.
Not in that package.
Oh, not in that package?
That's probably primarily going to be the PERS bond.
Oh, the PERS, yeah.
Bond contribution increase that used to be budgeted in state government service charges. The personal services increase due to merits would be reflected in their base budget. The things in that package 010 would be traditionally adjustments to mass transit tax, but primarily in all the budgets you're going to see the biggest bulk of that package is the PERS. I forget what the appropriate term is. It for
pension.
Thank you, Kelly, for the pension bond. What he said.
Pension obligation bond.
It's related to the PERS, solving the PERS problem from last session. We issued bonds, and now this is the. Is it the debt service, Kelly?
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So, since we're on the record, we're talking about this increased cost on personal service adjustments is the proportional share of the cost of interest on the refund the refinancing of the PERS debt.
Paying back the debt on that bond issue.
Right. Okay. Okay, it's paying back the debt on the PERS bond issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Right.
So, Chair Richardson, I think from the agency perspective, all of these essential packages are things that we were required to include in the budget and in the instructions that we got from budget management as we developed the budget. So we'll defer if we need a lot of explanation to our BAM analysts.
Thank you. Now, you wanted us to focus on page 53?
Yeah, and are there any other questions that anyone wants to bring forward at this point? If not, I just I know that you were concerned about time, so I think I just wanted to focus on we did put in a policy package, which was number 101 in our agency request, which initially we had requested that the donations fund that we used of $196,000 be replaced with general fund. We were feeling optimistic about the state's economy at that point. The governor is not recommending that, and we are now essentially requesting that we be given limitation within our other budget so that we can use our donated funds in that amount to give us. Well, our goal is to match the federal allotment that's available to our agency so that we can bring in the full, both older blind and vocational rehabilitation grants available to us. Additionally, we requested that 3.5 positions that we have currently in our budget as limited duration positions that are currently full be made into permanent positions, and the governor's recommended budget does approve that request. So really what we're focusing on is fully matching the federal allotment that's available using $196,000 approximately dollars of our donated fund. And I know earlier when we were talking about donated funds, we were discussing the use, and I do have a chart on page 54 which shows the historical use of donated funds within our budget. And you'll see that it did grow significantly between the 01, 03, and the 03, 05 biennium. Prior to that time, we had been operating under the, I guess it was the policy that the Commission Board had established that we would use the interest but not dip into the principal of the donations fund. But when we were...
On that, and this is probably the toughest question you have to deal with, and that is whether it's state funds or federal funds, it's still taxpayer money. And so the question is, why is it justifiable for the commission to have $793,000 of donated money in a savings account and then ask for taxpayers to make up as if that money wasn't there, you know, to be paying? And so maybe you could help me understand that.
Well, I think... part of what we want to do, obviously, is to continue to provide the services at the maximum level that we can. And so we are looking at using a substantial portion of what our donations fund is this biennium.
Okay, now would you clarify that? Because, as you said, your request was to replace the $196,000 that was done before and that the governor has not granted that request in his recommended budget. So that's not clear.
Yeah, at this point we are no longer requesting that. We're asking for the other limitation to allow us to use the $196,000 of donated money so that we could then match the federal program. If we were to continue to use our donated funds at that rate, we would last us about 4 biennium total. And we don't do anything to solicit the donations, and so it's kind of unpredictable the amounts that we receive. And typically, it's not large donations. We tend to get a lot of small donations from individuals that we have provided services to. So we're hoping that we can, continue to function at the level that we are with this additional use of the donated funds. I think that most of the donors that donate to us are looking at trying to not have it supplant taxpayers' money for a program that is a state program, and that has been a delicate issue, I think, for the Commission Board to deal with the fact that we think that we're currently in a position in the state where we need to use them, and I think that they made a very wise decision to move forward into that area of going into the principal to allow us to continue to have services as best we can with what's available to match the federal program.
Okay.
Did you want to add?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. And that's, and we've been through this over the last couple of bienniums as we've talked with some smaller agencies that receive donations. When you supplant state dollars with donated dollars, it tends to chill the giving of the donated dollars. People aren't as willing to, they're donating for special purposes or to enhance programs, and certainly it's legitimate in emergencies and in special circumstances and stuff to try and use those donated dollars to supplement a budget. And I've got no problem with that. But if we do it long enough and intensive enough, the source of the donations will probably dry up. Or it's very
assuming
likely
that the donors are aware of all of those things, but certainly I understand what you're saying, especially on a if the donations were coming from sophisticated foundations or that kind of thing. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure. Of the 2.579 in other funds under the 0507, is the 196,445 a part of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, yes.
Okay.
That is.
Okay. Did you have a comment, Deborah?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The governor's budget does assume that the continued policy of using donated funds to fund the program, and for me, and the agency might not agree, what this package is really about, because it doesn't increase the agency's budget, it simply allows them to make permanent the limited duration positions that they currently have. The package actually nets to zero. So if the package weren't approved, they would still have the expenditure limitation to deliver the program. It just wouldn't be as effective because they wouldn't have the positions in order to deliver the service.
Well, they would have the positions. They just wouldn't be permanent positions. Is that not correct?
Well, I suppose they could reestablish administratively limited duration positions and continue. That would certainly be an option.
This has been very informative. Thank you so much for your presentation, and if you felt like you were getting grilled, it's because this is the first time we've gone into phase two, and phase one is overview, and phase two is let's get to the real numbers because we have to make decisions, and so you got it both in the same presentation, and so you've been very responsive, and I want to commend Valentina Fominko on a very excellent presentation. I understand that's your first presentation here, and it was very informative. And thank you all for your time. Thank you all for attending and for participating in today's hearing. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.